Let me just, I'm just checking to see who's here. Hi, Felicia. Hi, Vanessa. Yay, okay, everyone's here. It's so good to see you, Felicia. Can everyone hear me okay? Okay, I'm so glad to be here with you because I'm having such a strong experience going through the work with you guys, and I hope you are too. And one of the things I want to say is, you know, as we get into the kind of the long haul of step one, you know, your head's going to start to say, this is too much, staying in this, this is too hard. You know, Felicia, you've done this many times. You know how your head can start taking you for a ride and taking you for a little trip. Don't ignore it. I always like to go back to me, what does a commitment mean to me? And I'm going to tell you something that it is important when you're working with new people that they have a commitment to their recovery. And I talked to them about what commitment means. Their commitment alone will not keep them sober, but having a commitment and keeping it, I can't keep a commitment well on my own power, but with the power of God, I keep a commitment. And it means that I show up, I do what I say, and I say what I do. And I know how today with recovery to keep a commitment. So remember that, you know, I think you're all committed, and remember that when you start, your head maybe will take off with you, and maybe your head doesn't. Maybe it's just my head, but I know enough of you that some of your heads can take off with you, and like Rick's head can take off with him. So he's laughing. But so we're finishing, we're into the first half of There Is a Solution. We're finishing the physical craving tonight. And I want to talk a minute about where we're at. Remember, we looked at the doctor's opinion to get a diagnosis, mainly the physical craving, to get a diagnosis that I have an abnormal reaction inside of me. It's inside of me. It's not external. It's the way I react to alcohol or drugs, except for opiates when they're in my system. And if you're an opiate addict, I can certainly talk to you one-on-one about it because it's a little different. But all meth, cocaine react the same as alcohol. So when I take any alcohol into my system, whatever, I lose control of the amount. I have an abnormal reaction. I can't control the amount. Maybe once in a while I can, most of the time I can't. I have to see that. Do I have this physical craving? Do I have this allergy to alcohol, this abnormal reaction? And we went into Bill's story. We looked at Bill's drunkalog, laying our experience next to it. Beginning when I'm working with a new person in the program, whether they've been in AA for a while or they're brand new to recovery and they've never done BBA, I want to talk to them about, in Bill's story, we begin to do what we want them to do in meetings, and that's to look for the similarities. And I talk and work with new people on how to listen in meetings. And I hope that you will consider that when you're working with new people. There's ways to listen in meetings for the similarities. When someone says something in a meeting, read it back to you where you've done something similar in your head. Begin to interact in your head with the meeting, because most of us come in with a very judgmental brain, and we are because they call me, the newcomers call me when they leave a meeting and tell me. So I want to show them how to listen in a meeting. And then we looked at the second half of Bill's story to see Bill's recovery. Was I as hopeless as Bill? And if I do what Bill did, will I get the recovery Bill had? And yes, I will, because that's been proven to me. So now we're at, there is a solution. What a promise, okay? And I'm gonna read because I think it's important. And if you can't hear me or anything like that, you let me know. I think it's important to read the whole book. So here we go. There is a solution. One of the things is, before I start this, is don't focus on the drama. We want to focus on the common solution, not where alcohol took us, not where drugs took us. And I will talk more about that as we go into this chapter, because the drama of where it took us will not be our common problem. The common problem is inside. Okay, there's a solution. We have Alcoholics Anonymous, know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. And I say to myself, was I as hopeless as Bill? Wanted to quit, but can't. Yes, I was. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. There's the promise. There's a solution to the promise. They've solved the drink problem. Okay. We are average Americans. All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented. They're showing me in this paragraph that alcohol does not discriminate, not with race, not with color, not with financial status. There's no discrimination with alcohol. We are average Americans. All sections of the country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economical, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix, but there exists among us. Number one, this is what exists among us. A fellowship, that's a promise. Friendliness, that's a promise. And an understanding, which is indescribably wonderful. And I say to myself, as I'm going through this with 31 years clean and sober, I say to myself, is that the way I'm going to meetings? Is that the attitude I'm bringing to meetings today? We are like the passengers of a great liner the moment after after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie and joyousness and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain table. Unlike the feelings of the ship's passengers, however, our joy and escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril, peril is problem, having shared in a common problem is one element in the powerful cement which binds us. Excuse me. But that in itself, the common problem, would never have held us together as we are now joined. So now they're telling me that there is, when you look at the circle and triangle, they're looking at the fellowship side of the circle and triangle, okay? The unity side. That in the meetings, in the fellowship, we are going to find the common problem. And they're telling me that by itself will never be enough to keep me recovered and sober, okay? And it says it's one element in the powerful cement which binds us, okay? And it sounds silly, this cement thing, but when we get done with a fifth step, you need to know what it means. I'll go over it to you when we finish a fifth step, because it's going to talk about mixing the cement. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. Common problem found in the fellowship, common solution found in the big book. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. I don't think today, I think one of the problems in Alcoholics Anonymous is that we don't have a way out on which we can absolutely agree. We have to remember that when AA began, they had a 75% recovery rate and they had one book. They didn't have a bunch of pamphlets except coming out of Cleveland with Clarence Schneider. He was doing some pamphlets, but no pamphlets. They had one book and their recovery rate was very different. Today, we have a lot of different books. We have a lot of pamphlets. We have a lot of different ways out. But I know that if I stick with the common solution, which is found in this book and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action, and I say to myself, am I going to meetings with that attitude, brotherly and harmonious action? Am I going and bringing that to meetings? Action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. Okay, the common solution is the news that the book carries. This is the basic text. There's nothing else that has this. There's no other basic text in Alcoholics Anonymous, not the 12 and 12, none of them. This is the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous, okay? So I'm gonna go over to the next page. This is another representation on the top of 18 of the spiritual malady. Remember that we saw the spiritual malady in the doctor's opinion where they talk about restless, irritable, and discontent. Now you're seeing another explanation of it. Okay, I have notes, so I just have to look over my notes. I have notes for each page. Okay. So, top of 18, another description of spiritual malady. An illness of this sort, and we have come to believe it is an illness. And I say to myself, with all the time I have in the program, do I still believe it's an illness, or have I gotten well enough that I no longer have this illness? Because remember, alcoholism illness is progressive. If I should pick up a drink today, it would have been like I was drinking for 31 years. It wouldn't be like I picked up where I left off. No, 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 no. And the spiritual malady is also progressive. So do I believe I suffer from illness? Yes, I do. And this illness involves those about me in a way no other human sickness can. If a person has cancer, all are sorry for him and no one is angry or hurt. And I use that analogy when I'm working with people about people having cancer, for with it goes the annihilation. Annihilation is destruction of all the things worthwhile in life. It engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. And I think back, you know, about my life, you know, before I got sober. And any person, the last 8 years or so of my drinking and using, anyone that came in contact with me or spent any time with me, they were going to be touched. And I'm not going to tell you in a positive way, by my addiction, by my alcoholism, by my problems, and by the insanity that surrounded my life. It engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children and wives, sad wives and parents. Anyone can increase the list. So I look at this and I go over it. And when I'm working with people, I go over it and ask them. So I want to read the questions to you. Have I come to believe that I suffer from an illness? Yes, I do. What worthwhile in my life was annihilated by my drinking and using? My career, my self-respect, my morals, my health, my friends, my family, my employees, my employers, and my finances. Where did my alcoholism bring misunderstanding? This is from my state. No one understood me at the end because I lied so much, and I would blame and justify to get what I wanted, and I was upset that people didn't buy my lies and they didn't understand me. Fierce resentment. Where did I have that? I caused fierce resentment, mine and theirs. I hated and resented everything because I hated and resented myself. I hated life because I was a loser and couldn't get it together. Financial insecurity. At the end, I had to prostitute and hustle to get what I needed. Fear ran my life. Disgusted friends and employers. I took advantage of my... Oh, you guys, excuse me. I'm going to just shut the window, because the dogs are barking next door. So sorry. Okay. So, disgusted friends and employers. I took advantage of my talent, because I was a fashion designer for 18 years. And expected people to do what I wanted and work around me. I was incapable of predicting if I could hold a commitment to a job. Disgusted friends. I was so hot and cold and good sometimes. Fair weather drug friend, fair weather alcoholic friend. When I became a heroin addict, I lost lots of friends. Well, that's because I cheated and lied a lot, used people and operated from a survival mode. Sad partners. I used and abused everyone that I was ever in a relationship with. Parents, I blamed them and sometimes didn't call for years. I didn't call my parents. I had dreams at the end. I wanted to shoot my parents. I had dreams of taking an AK-47 and shooting them on the golf course. That's how violent that I get, okay? So I wanted to share that with you, and I hope that you filled it out and read it to who you were doing the steps with. Okay, so that's that description. We hope this volume will inform and comfort those who are or may be affected. There are many. I'm going to skip down. They're going to give me 12 things that are going to tell me the 12 attributes of finding a sponsor, looking for a sponsor, or being a sponsor. There's 12 things, and I get out a pen, and I hope you'll write these down as I go through them, because they're good to share with the people that you work with. It's not a have to, but it's a very good indication, okay? It says down in the bottom of the page, I say to myself, do I meet or does my sponsor meet these 12 attributes, okay? First it says, but the ex-problem drinker, that's number one. So I say to myself, am I an ex-problem drinker? Yes, I am. That's number one. Have I found the solution? Number two is found the solution. Have I found the solution? That's number two. Yes, I found the solution. Who is properly armed with facts about himself can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. That's number three. So it's saying to me right there, when I'm talking to a new person, I'm to spend a couple hours with them. And, you know, I don't always do that, but I know I spend enough time to find out. I always find out if they are a real alcoholic or a real addict before. And sometimes it can be vague, but most of the times you can find out. And, you know, we say it's a self-diagnosis program, but I'm not working with anyone that I'm not sure is not an alcoholic. And if you turn to your big book on page 93, it's going to tell you that. hold on. It's going to say, if you are satisfied on 92 that he is a real alcoholic. So it says to me, I'm supposed to be satisfied he's a real alcoholic. So I find that out. That was number three. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accumulated, can be accomplished. Until I make that connection with that new person or person that has time that I'm going to work with, I need to make that connection. I need to see that it's a good fit for both of us. And number one, that the man, this is number four, that the man who is making the approach has the same difficulty. Is he like me? Like addiction should work with like addiction. It does not do good necessarily for an alcoholic to sponsor a heroin addict. They are talking a different language. We need to have a commonality, okay? Was he like me? Number five, that he obviously knows what he's talking about. Okay. That his whole deportment means behavior, that his whole behavior, this is number six, his whole behavior shouts at the new prospect that he is a man with a real answer, living the book. That's the real answer, living the big book. Number seven, that he has no attitude of holier than thou. Number eight, nothing whatever except the sincere desire to be helpful. Number nine, no fees to pay. Number 10, no axes to grind. Number 11, no people to please. Number 12, no lectures to be endured. When I'm sponsoring people, sometimes I make them open to this page and cross out no lectures to be endured. I may be giving them what I think is a lecture. They laugh. Oh, I know Rick's laughing because I probably did it with him. So, okay, those are very important things. You don't have to have all of them, but just having the same problem, making this connection, these kind of things are so important. Is he a man or woman with a real answer? Living the book, the answer's in the book, okay? These are the conditions. These are the conditions we have found most effective. That word effective needs to be circled. And when I'm working with others, when I'm doing a workshop, when I'm taking people through the work, I always am considering, when I'm looking at a nightly review, when I'm trying to grow in my understanding and ability to do better at carrying this message, because this is the kind of growth. There's no growth to me that's ever been in my life that has been better than trying to grow spiritually and effectiveness in carrying this message. I don't say, was I good? Was I bad? I say, was I effective? Did it work? Right? And it talks about being effective in the last page of step 11, okay? After such an approach, many take up their beds and walk again. That's also a promise, okay? Now, okay. None of us makes a sole vacation of this work, nor do we think its effectiveness, there it is, would be increased if we did. We feel that elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. Okay, so just not drinking, coming out of treatment, I'm not drinking anymore, is that enough? They think eliminating the drinking is not enough, but it's a beginning. A much more important demonstration of our principles, and it's a good thing for you to think, what are the principles? Because there's a lot of principles in this big book. The 12 steps are principles, but there's a lot of principles in the big book, way different than the principles that are on the wall now, those 12-step principles that I don't know where the hell they got them, because there are so many principles in this book. As we go through the book, you can certainly begin to mark principles in the book. All of us spend much of our spare time in the sort of effort which we are going to describe. A few are fortunate enough to be situated that they can give nearly all their time to the work. If this, they say this twice. They say it in that paragraph I just read, and they say it again in this one. So it shows me how important it is. If we keep on the way we are going, just not drinking, there is no doubt that much good will not result. There will not be good results if I just go on the way I'm going, just not drinking. So they said that twice. But this, because the surface of the problem would hardly be scratched. Those of us who live in large cities are overcome by the reflection that close by, hundreds are dropping into oblivion every day. Many could recover if they had the opportunity we have enjoyed. How then shall we present that which has been given has been so freely given to us. That's what brought about the Big Book Awakening groups and meetings, was because the call of so many people wanting to do it. And how do we reach them? You know, because we can all just be going to meetings and sharing in meetings, but that so many people wanted to do it, that it just seemed it would be much more effective that we had a place where they could come to. And that had proven to be true. So we have been able to help lots of people recover in San Diego, and lots of other places have taken up doing the BBA. We have concluded to publish an anonymous volume, setting forth the problem as we see it. Now, this is very important. Pay attention to this line. We shall bring to task our combined experience and knowledge. I don't want your knowledge. I want your experience and your knowledge. Knowledge is in your head. If you don't have experience with the knowledge of this book, which I don't think I had enough experience with it when I was 12 years sober and I got the Big Book Awakening. I think that's one thing I was missing. This should suggest a useful program for anyone concerned with a drinking or using problem. Of necessity, there will be discussion of matters. Okay, now, when I'm working with someone, I point this out strongly to them. Do you see the books warning you? Don't come back to tell me they're talking about religion, and they're telling you they're going to talk about it. So get over yourself. They're warning you. It's not a surprise. So of necessity, there will be a discussion of matters medical, psychiatric, social, and religious. We are aware that these matters are, from their very nature, controversial. Nothing would please us so much as to write a book which would contain no basis for contention or argument. Do I stay away from contention and argument also? We shall do our utmost to achieve that ideal. Most of us, here's a beautiful principle to live by. Most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints, and a respect for their opinions, are attitudes which make us more useful to others. That is absolutely a beautiful principle. Our very lives, and that's a promise, and the next one is too. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others and how we can help meet their needs. Do I have friends that live like that? Do I have friends that live that they think of others constantly and how they can meet their needs? I do. I mean, I have Pat T, I had Dan Sherman, I had people that really think. It doesn't mean we don't take care of ourselves, but that we have this other piece that we're kind of always thinking about, what can I do to help someone? And, you know, when I get up in the morning and do prayer and meditation, one of the questions I ask God is, who can I call today? Who needs my help today? And you'll become to see that some name, you know, from nowhere will just pop in your head. And then you'll, if you follow the direction, then you'll call them and you'll see that how much they needed to get a call from you. I just want to look at my notes. Now. Okay. So here we are on page 20. You may already have asked yourself, well, I guess we got to ask ourselves why it is that we, all of us, became so very ill from drinking. They are telling us over and over, this is an illness. This isn't, I'm not a bad person. I have an illness. It's serious as cancer. Okay. Doubtless you are curious to discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. If you're an alcoholic who wants to get over it, and do I want to get over it? I want a new experience. I want to get over it. That's why I'm doing the work with you guys. So I may already be asking, what do I have to do? What do I have to do? So alcoholism is a serious progressive illness of body, mind, spirit, and emotions. Do I see that? Okay. And I want to share this with you. One of the benefits of having this illness and being an alcoholic is that from this illness, God has given me the gift to show others the way out of drinking, the key to life and happiness for others. So out of this place of alcoholism, I was given a gift of the key to life, happiness for others, to be recovered. It is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. What questions? What do I have to do? We shall tell you what we have done. Oh, They're saying to us, they're going to tell me what they've done. They're not going to tell me what I need to do. When I'm working with someone, I need to tell them what I have done. Oh, sometimes I do tell them what they need to do. But if they, but you know what I mean? But they're going to tell me from their experience, because experience speaks to my heart. Knowledge speaks to my head. And this is a heart-to-heart program. Before going into detailed discussion, it may be well to summarize some points as we see them. So they're going to show us some ideas about this. How many times people have said to us, I want to read it to you from my notes, because I made notes to read it to you. Okay. And I hope you read that and put in your own experience. Can I take it or leave it alone? I can't take it and I can't leave it alone. Why not? Craving obsession. Can I drink like a gentleman or quit? Why not? Craving obsession. Can I handle my liquor or dope? Why not? Craving obsession. Can I choose to drink just beer and wine or smoke pot, no meth? Why not? Craving obsession. Can I stay off the hard stuff like heroin and vodka? Why not? Craving obsession. Is my willpower not enough? And why not? Craving obsession. Okay, I'm going to go to the next paragraph. Now, these are commonplace observations on drinkers. People have said this to me 1,000 times. You know, one of the good signs that you have a problem with alcohol is if when you're drinking with people, they're shaking their heads when they look at you. You know how they do? Oh, Tyler. Oh, right? And one of the famous big guys in AA, Bob O says that, and I love that. I think it's hilarious. He says, if your friends are shaking their heads at you when you drink, you probably, did anyone shake their head at you, Rick? Oh yeah. Yeah, me too. Now, these are commonplace observations on drinkers, which we hear all the time. Back of them is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. Ignorance and misunderstanding, even by us, even in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's incredible amounts of misunderstanding about what you can do. You can just wake up. Oh, I hope Joe will share. He just wake up later, Joe, you better share this. And I just don't drink no matter what. That can send Joe into a total spin. We see that these expressions refer to people whose reactions are very different than ours. So they're going to take me into 3 types of drinkers, and I need to see what I am. Moderate drinkers have little trouble giving up liquor entirely if they have a good reason. Well, they can take it or leave it alone. I want to read you my notes. Hold on. Okay. Do I say in AA meetings or to myself that I have no problem stopping, that it is staying stopped that I have a problem with? Do I see that if that is true, I don't suffer from the phenomenon of craving and that my solution is to drink when the obsession comes, then stop when I want to, since it isn't stopping that I have a problem with? Do I have faith in being able to choose not to drink every time I think of drinking because I now want to stay stopped? Am I willing to accept if I can do that, then I may likely be a moderate drinker and not a real alcoholic? Am I a moderate drinker? And I'm going to read the paragraph to moderate drinker. Okay. I just read it. So I'm going to read again. Moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they have a good reason. And you can think back in your life. I did not start off as a moderate drinker. I was an alcoholic from the beginning. But if you were, you can think back of all the good reasons that you had to moderate or stop, that they can quit entirely if they have a good reason. I had lots of good reasons, and I couldn't moderate and I couldn't stop. I'm not a moderate drinker. I never was a moderate drinker. Okay. Then we have a certain type of hard drinker. Let's see if any of us here are hard drinkers. He may have the habit. He has the habit. He does not have the obsession. He has the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. Oh, I did. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. It sure could have. If a sufficiently strong reason. Okay. I want you to circle sufficiently strong reason. That is a threat. That is a fear. if given a sufficiently strong reason, they can stop or moderate. Okay. And let's look at some of the sufficiently strong reasons. Ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative. This man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome and may even need medical attention. So that hard drinker, which there are a lot of hard drinkers in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, that hard drinker can look more alcoholic on the outside than an alcoholic. They can have been to more treatment centers. They can have been gotten more DUIs. They have gotten could have gotten in more divorces and more trouble as a result of their drinking. Yeah. Yeah. Marie, did you say something?
We couldn't hear. I couldn't hear you for a minute.
But, could you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. Hear just you. Tell me. If, what?
I can hear you.
Okay. Just tell me anyone that if you can't hear me, tell me. They can look more alcoholic than an alcoholic, okay? When I was doing a woman's meeting at Scripps McDonald Center, when they had a treatment center there, I was sponsoring a lot of the gals that were coming out of the treatment center, and it was a woman's meeting. And there were a couple of times that I worked with some newcomer, right? And she kind of quit at step three. And then a few years later, I'd run into her and she says, "And how you doing?" You know, I'd ask her, "How you doing?" She said, "Oh, I'm doing great. You know, I don't do the program and I can control my drinking." At those years, I did not understand this. I didn't understand that she was a hard drinker and that she could stop or moderate. And that threat of being in treatment, that was enough for her to stop or moderate, which she moderated her drinking. And when I was designing clothes, I had a gal that I designed clothes with. I ran one division, she ran the other. And we used to party after work all the time. I was in my late 20s and we would be doing a lot of coke and drinking. And I remember I was at her house. Her name was Fran. I was at her house one time after we'd been doing this probably for 6 months. And I was at her house after work and she said, and you know, there was cocaine out on the table and we were drinking. And she said to me, she said, "Tyler, I just got to tell you something." And I said, "Yeah, what?" She said, "I can't do this anymore." I was shocked. I said, "You can't do what?" I mean, I couldn't imagine she was going to say, "I can't sit around and do coke and drink anymore." She said that she was quitting. She could not do it. She was not like me. I never had a desire to quit. She had a desire inside who she was to quit, and she was able to quit. She was not like me. So I have to see, and I'm going to tell you, I don't know if anyone's on this call. I mean, not anyone on the call, but anyone's on the workshop tonight that may find out that they're a hard drinker. I know a lot of you, so I don't think so, but there could be. And sometimes you can find out that you're a hard drinker. And a lot of times people, when I've worked with them and they find out they're a hard drinker, they don't want to be a hard drinker. So they want to ignore it, but you know, that's okay. So I want to read something to you. Okay. So have I been able to moderate my drinking or stay stopped because a sufficient strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, warning of a doctor? Do I say in meetings or to myself that I'll stay sober because of an important reason, such as I'm staying sober for my family? Have you heard that in meetings? I'm staying sober because last time I relapsed, my family was mad at me. I'm staying sober because if I don't, my husband will divorce me. I'm staying sober because, you know what, if I miss any more work, I'll lose my job. I'm staying sober because I have emotional problems. I'm staying sober because if I get busted again, I'll be sent to jail. Do I understand that the examples above are mental defenses against the first drink? Do I have to be reminded by Bill's story on page 8? He says in the middle, "Fear sobered me up for a bit because the fear of these things happening should I drink again will not keep a real alcoholic sober forever. I have no mental defense," and we'll talk about in the next chapter. "Am I willing to accept that if I can stop or moderate my drinking on that basis, I may likely be a hard drinker and not an alcoholic? Am I a hard drinker?" I'm not a hard drinker, and I know that well. So now I would like, you guys don't know Rachel. Rachel is here tonight. Rachel is the only Al-Anon on our workshop. And a dear, dear friend and sponsee of mine who I love. And I asked her, she's on, I'm not taking typically any Al-Anons on this workshop, but I'm taking Rachel because we are rewriting the 1, 2, 3 questionnaire for fixing and controlling. And she wanted to be on for some of it to add some more ideas to the fixing and controlling. But I talked to her and I asked her if she would just read for us. Hi, Rachel. She would read for us in answering the questions of a hard drinker. I want you to hear her answers. So pay attention. Okay. Yay, Rachel. Thank you, baby.
Thank you, Tyla. Hi, I'm Rachel. I'm an Al-Anon controller fixer. So, you know, answering the hard drinker questions, it says at the top, and I thought this was important, you know, there are those people too who drank and used with us. I was one of them, right? Who were able to keep up with us, definitely me. They drank as much as we did and used the same drugs we did, but something happened which caused them to stop or moderate on their own. Perhaps they got married, had children, got a DUI. They grew out of it while we continue to grow into it. And I think it's really important to say part of my story, just really quick, I'll keep it brief, is that, you know, I started drinking and using when I was 12. And by the time I was 13, 14, I mean, I was drinking every weekend. I'd drink, but I smoked pot every day. I think I smoked pot from the time I was like 13 until I met my husband, you know, and I was 21. But the biggest thing for me is, I mean, that was it. Like everything for me was, you know, getting high, you know, I'd go to school, I'd walk right back out the back door and I'd be partying, you know, during the day while I was supposed to be at school. Just all the different things that you see people doing. You know, I had 3 underage drinking, got arrested 3 times before I was 16, had all the fines for it, but I just kept partying and I partied because I wanted to escape. I wanted, you know, and I would drink to the point of getting sick. You know, I had alcohol poisoning. I had, you know, there was a lot of dangerous things that happened to me throughout my life. And there came a point in my life. And I remember because we were all partying and we watched this movie and it's really relevant. It was kind of a big deal for me, but it was this indie movie in the 90s called Kids, right? And I watched it with my friends and we were all partying. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is my life. And I don't want to live this way. And at that point, you know, things started to change. And so I saw a lot of people growing into their disease. You know, my boyfriend, my best friend, my mom, some other people that I would party with. And I was like, I don't want to do this, you know, and I just kind of started making that decision. And some really bad things happened to the people around me. I started losing friends to addiction. I started, you know, my mom progressed in hers. It just got really crazy. And that's where I started to pull back and say, I can't live this way. Now, I didn't completely stop for a long time. But with that, I'll go ahead.
You could moderate.
I could moderate, but it still wasn't my friend. I still shouldn't. And I really want to say, and I don't know enough Al-Anons talk about this, but I really rode that line for a long time. And drinking and using got me into a lot of trouble. I mean, it really was part of my bottom as an Al-Anon and a codependent and controller fixer, because I thought I had it all down and I didn't. Like I was still using in a hard way. And I was doing it, you know, to try to control the alcoholic in my life. And it was just crazy, but it wasn't my friend. And I don't know. And even early in my recovery, I would still, you know, drink to like chill out, you know, and God put it on my heart, like really strong. You can't do this anymore. Like if you're in recovery, like you need to stop. This isn't a way to soothe. This isn't a way to relax. And I was really convicted. So even as an Al-Anon non-alcoholic, I don't have the physical part. I was convicted that I can't be doing this anymore because it's separating me from God. It's separating me from other people. I was hiding. I wasn't, you know, telling people, yeah, you know, I went to a meeting and then I went home and had a glass of wine. Like it wasn't right. And I wasn't even telling my best friend that who's in the program. So, you know, or my sponsor. And that wasn't right. But anyway, so let me get to the questions. I just wanted to give you guys like a kind of a brief, my story. So, did I have a habit badly enough to gradually impair me physically and mentally? And I said, yes. And you know, especially because I had some other problems. I was taking prescription medication from my doctor and I still was drinking on top of it. And it was very dangerous. Could it cause me to die a few years before my time? I said, yes, there are times that I could have died, alcohol poisoning. I really liked hallucinogenics, impaired driving, unprotected sex. I was used to spend time with really unsafe people and would go to really unsafe places. Could I stay stopped if given sufficiently strong reason, examples? And I said, yes, if I was asked to be the designated driver, I could just not drink. I'd stop for work. I stopped because my husband was in the military and, you know, I had to behave a certain way. I stopped for pregnancy, for my parenting responsibilities, seeing others progressing in their addiction, not wanting to live that life, being mean when and depressed when I drank. I knew that I couldn't do that. So, and feeling out of control. I didn't like feeling out of control. And one of the biggest things was, is like when my friends went out and started doing harder drugs, I was like, oh, I don't want to do that. It makes me feel out of control. Anyway, so for ill health, yes, my doctor told me to limit my alcohol or don't use it at all. So I was able to stop doing that, falling in love. Yes, my husband asked for me not to drink around my mom or only drink one around my mom. And I was able to. Change of environment. Yeah, it never really applied. A warning from a doctor, yes. And again, like if the doctor, employer, judge, yes. If you fell in love, yes. If you moved to a different place, yes. Am I a hard drinker? And I said I was a few different times in my life, but always could moderate or stop.
Thank you, Rachel. That's awesome. It's so good. I hope you guys could. Thank you so much, honey.
Thank you, Rachel.
It was so good for us. I hope you guys could hear the difference that, you know, Rachel didn't like to feel out of control. That was the effect I was looking for. Okay, so let's get, I'm going to wrap this up with you guys. The next paragraph, it says, what about the real alcoholic? Okay, is that me? He may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker, but at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. That's it. That's the bottom line. In order to be an alcoholic, I must have the physical craving. Is there anyone here in this workshop that thinks they can be an alcoholic and not have the physical craving? Please make a note of that when I open it up in a couple of minutes for discussion, because I want you to share, because I have to have mental obsession and physical craving to be powerless. If I only have the physical craving and not the mental obsession, I don't have to go to the bar. Just stay out of the bar. I don't have to buy liquor. I don't have mine that's going to take me there. So if I only have a mental obsession and not the physical craving, I can go to the bar every night and have two drinks and go home. I'm not powerless unless I have both. Okay. Now the next paragraph. So when I'm working with someone, that's the bottom line. When you're working with someone, most of the time, they're going to know if they have physical craving when they come out of the doctor's opinion. The next paragraph is going to tell a lot about the behavior as a result of drinking and using. And I'm not going to read it. You can read it on your own, because it does not tell me whether I'm an alcoholic or not. What I do under the influence, DUIs, not DUIs. You just heard Rachel. She did as many things as most alcoholics. How do I 12-step the woman up the street, which I have 12-step people where I lived before, because I up from me is a very rich neighborhood. And I go up there to 12-step this woman, and she's an alcoholic and she's a pill user and she's never left her house and she doesn't have one bit of drama in her life. If I begin to talk to her about the drama of my life, if I begin to tell her how I turned tricks and I begin to tell her how I was arrested and went before state grand juries, I won't have anything in common with her. But if I talk to her about the physical craving, I talk to her about the mental obsession and the spiritual malady, we're talking the same language. So the thing that will make us that different a lot of times will be the result of, and I don't want to bring that to that person. I want to bring what the common problem is. So I'm going to go over to the next page. Please go over to the next page. And you can read that on your own. This is by no means the middle of the page. This is by no means all that behavior stuff they talk about. This is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic, as our behavior patterns vary. That's why the result of is not an indication of whether I'm an alcoholic or not. But this description should identify him roughly. Why does he behave like this? If hundreds of experience have shown Tyler that one drink means another trip to the federal court, another disaster with all its attendant suffering and humiliation. Why does Kyla take that first drink? Why does she go score that damn Coke? Why is she high on heroin one more time? Why can't she stay stopped? What has become of her common sense and willpower that she sometimes displays with respect to other matters? I don't have any common sense or willpower. Maybe you do. Perhaps there will never be a full answer to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently from normal people. We are not sure why, once a certain point is reached, once I cross that line into the physical craving, and I had it from the beginning, but I know other people that really started to have it later on. Little can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle. This is the end of physical craving. We know that while Tyla keeps away from drink, as she may do for months or years, oh brother, that wasn't true, as I might have done for a few hours or days, she reacts much like other people. That I did not, but I know other people that did. We're equally positive that once Tyla takes any alcohol, whatever, into her system, something happens both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for Tyla to stop. The experience of any alcoholic, including Tyla, will abundantly confirm this. So the way I turn that into a statement is the bottom line. That's it. Put a line on the top of 23 where it says confirm this, put a line across your book and says end of physical. But I turn that into a statement, a question. Does my experience abundantly confirm that once I put any alcohol or dope into my system, something happens both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for me to stop until I get to that place? And I don't know if that's going to be 3 days, 2 hours, two women's husbands, one husband's wife, who knows, the way I party. I don't know when. And I don't know if I ever get to that place. And I don't say the place of ease and comfort because I don't believe that's when I stop. Because I don't got to ease and comfort. You know, we talked about that being a lie, chasing that lie. But I don't know when I'm going to get to that place, whatever that place is going to be. Does my experience abundantly confirm that? And you have to have that. I have to have that I cannot stop. Once alcohol is in my system, something happens both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for me to stop until I get to that place. And I don't know when that's going to be. Thank you for letting me share. It's now open for sharing. Please, anyone would like to share, unmute.
My name is Robert. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Robert.
So you said that you've got to have both parts, right, to be an alcoholic, the physical That's and right. the mental. Okay.
Be powerless, yes.
Okay. And maybe they're just referencing this in a different way, but the very first paragraph in We Agnostics.
I'm not going to go into agnostics. If you want to call me, the first paragraph you're talking about where it says or.
Yes.
I was told that was by the guys that really knew the big book, that was a drunk trap to see if someone's going to argue at that point with you.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? Like if I'm reading to someone and because you have to, it really has to say and. Because I knew when you said that, then I wanted to answer it because it's important because I didn't understand either. But the guys that know the big book a lot better than me said it's a drunk trap. And so if I'm working with someone and then they say, see, Tyler, see, you don't have to have this. I know that something's missing, that they don't get it.
Okay.
Right? Because we've already done 54 pages of the first step and they better know that they have a mental obsession and a physical craving. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yes.
Okay, honey. So that's a great question.
I've heard people, anyway, like speakers talk about that a lot. And it just, anyway.
Now, if you only have the physical craving, how are you powerless?
Right. Okay. No, that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Good question.
Thanks.
Tyler? Anything else, Robert?
No, that was it.
Okay, honey. Who would like to share?
Alicia.
Helen, go on.
Hi. I want to thank you for this evening, Tyla. As we were going through it, this last part here really stuck out to me what has become of the common sense and willpower. And I know just as it, I do relate very much to once taking the first drink, I just never knew when I would stop. And in that very end, that was a question I found myself saying, what happened? Like, what happened to my willpower? What happened to my great resolve? What happened to me? I used to be able to, you know, make good decisions and have good sense. And this doesn't even make sense anymore. I knew I was well past the point of it's just a casual drink, or I'm just taking the edge off. Even my own excuses or justifications of why I would even pick up that first drink, realizing that I'm in this danger zone of it's making me sick. My hands are peeling. I'm having physical effects. I'm scared. I'm killing myself, like literally wondering, afraid to go to the doctor at this point for fear of what I might be doing to myself on the inside. And yet I can't not drink. And those are the things that just really just scared me. And yet all that fear, it still did not keep me from picking up the drink, still scrounging together money when I didn't even have money to be drinking anymore. And that was all like, I couldn't even understand what was going on. I felt demon possessed. I felt completely demon possessed. Mm-hmm. And so that question, what has become of the common sense and willpower? And I know we'll speak of this on the next page in the next week, but it's like my family too was like, what has become of you? What has become of your common sense? I mean, and they didn't actually see me drinking. I was a very closeted drinker, but they knew I was not myself. They knew that I was becoming a recluse and somewhat of a crazy person. I acted like a crazy person. I seemed like somebody who wasn't doing much of anything and probably in there just hiding away doing who knows what. And then I had all the signs once it was known what I was doing later after I came out. This was my big coming out. I'm an alcoholic, I'm saved. But I didn't tell anybody till I got into AA. But I think the biggest question was, what has become of me? And I just didn't know that I was truly ill. I did not know. And when I got here, I was relieved. I was relieved to find out what was going on, because quite frankly, I thought I was losing my mind and I did not see any hope. Because when you believe that your only your power is your willpower and you've lost it, and your only way, your way of reaching out to God is so blocked and it's ineffective, and you don't know what to make of that, well, then you may as well jump. Just jump. I mean, like, what do you have left? And so I'm grateful that there is a solution. I'm grateful that my willpower was not necessary. It was God's will. And I had a lot of things to get out of the way of God's will, but you all taught me that. And once you told me, I knew you were telling the truth, and it is proven to be true. So thanks for letting me share.
Thank you for sharing.
Hi, Tyler.
Go on. Who's Tyler, asking to share?
Tyler, I had a question.
Yes, baby, you can share.
Okay. I've not heard it referenced this way, so I'd just like to hear what you meant by it. But what is a drunk trap? And I've not heard it referenced that way before. So if you could help me on that.
Well, I'll talk more about it when we get to We Agnostics. But what a drunk trap is, it's a place where someone can get caught and you can catch them at what they may not understand.
Got it.
If you don't understand that you have the physical craving or the mental obsession on the top of 44, when you say that, the person's going to say, see, I don't need to have it. And you can know that person you're working with,
right,
needs more clarity. If they don't know by the top of 44, there's a real problem. And there's a real problem about you as a sponsor if they don't know. But that's what these guys told me. So
thank you,
question.
Tyler. I appreciate you breaking it down.
You're welcome.
Hi, Tyler. Hey, it's Marie.
Go on, baby.
Go ahead.
No, you go.
Okay. Well, I I'm a real alcoholic. And I know that because when I put, once I put alcohol into my system, I have an allergy and I do not know what's going to happen after that. And, you know, I never looked back at myself. I never looked at myself and thought I was doing something weird. I just thought that's what happened when people drink and do drugs. And I hung out with a lot of people that drank the way I did and used the way I did. I wasn't around my family when I was using. And so I would be gone for years. And, you know, I at first I couldn't drink very much because I have a sensitive stomach and I would throw up. But once somebody introduced me to cocaine, it was someone I didn't know. And I married him a month later. I had had a boyfriend for 5 years and this guy gives me cocaine and I'm like, I'm in love. I didn't even tell my parents. I lived in a different city, but that cocaine allowed me to drink as much as I wanted to. And that was what I wanted to do. And, you know, I didn't start out all the time to go out and be, you know, a heat sinking missile trying to find cocaine. I'd go out with friends and want to have a couple drinks. But when I put a cup and they go home, but when I put a couple drinks in, the party's just getting started and I don't go home. I keep on going until there's no more or I pass out. So I know for me that because of that physical craving and is so strong in me, that I'm definitely an alcoholic, not a hard drinker. Thanks.
Thank you. You know, we're looking at, am I physically an alcoholic? Am I physically powerless over alcohol and drugs in loss of control, except like I said, opiates. So if you guys are sharing tonight, it's nice to hear if you think you are physically a real alcoholic. You can just add that to your share if you want.
Would I physically know that I'm
you did it. Yeah, you did great. Okay. Jerry, Don, Fernando, which one of you guys wants to share? You know you're not going to get away with four of you at a table and not share.
Jerry, alcoholic.
Hi, Jerry.
Kyla. I'm just thinking back to when the first time I went to the dentist, they gave me, instead of Novocaine, I got the laughing gas. And I was 10 years old, and that opened up Pandora's box. I chased that high for the next 27 years, and when I look back on it. And when I think about it, it didn't matter, you know, oh, you're afraid of success, you're afraid of, you're a fear. It didn't matter if it was a 49ers game on the TV. It didn't matter if it was Thursday night. I just wanted it. And I know I'm a real alcoholic. There is no question. I have never controlled the amount that I put in my body. I've always wanted more. And once it hits my body, there's no stopping it. Like you said, it could be 2 days. It could be 2 weeks. For me, it was 27 years, basically. And of always wanting more and never, ever being satisfied, never getting enough. And I still won't get enough to this day. I know that because I've tried. And the questions tonight were wonderful going over with the guys. There was never any control. There was the wish. I always wished I could try, you know, but as soon as I get off work, when I was able to hold down a job, it'd be right to the liquor store for the ride home for two tall boys and a bag of Doritos. I mean, and then if it was Friday night, it was guaranteed take a check to the dope man. And then it became not just Fridays, not just after work. It had become every half hour, you know, I could have been running with Joe hitting the pipe because that's where my life went and it was gone. And it didn't matter that she left and took our baby. It didn't matter that my parents were worried sick. It didn't matter. It's because I wanted to do what I wanted to do, no matter who it hurt. And now just going through the work and it's bringing up a lot of feelings. This stuff's great. But my physical craving is, you know, we could talk about it, sit here with Don and John, or even when Joe talks, I'll start salivating thinking about it. It's still in there. My body will still say, yeah, let's do it. If I put it in there, all bets are off. So thanks for doing this. I'm really enjoying it.
I'm so glad that you shared what you shared, you know, and one of the things is that, you know, my head will tell me, oh, I don't know why you're doing a first step. You know it, you're 31 years, but you know what? I have to have an open mind for a new experience. I need a new experience, no matter what my head tells me. I need to have a new experience. And I don't know what that new experience is, but I know that God knows what it is. And if I put myself in a position to receive the grace of a new experience, because I'm going to tell you, I can show you anyone that's in the program that tells me how much they know that they're an alcoholic or they know they're an addict. And I can show you how much they know it by the program they work. Because if their program doesn't reflect it, they're full of it. Because then they're living like a non-alcoholic. They're trying to control their not drinking. They're trying to control their not using. But the evidence of my knowing it will be in my program and how many people I sponsor. Thank you for letting me just chime in there for a minute. Hey, Dylan, where are you?
I'm here.
Hi, Dylan.
Hi, how are you? I'll share. My name is Dylan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, honey.
It's funny because, you know, I've been able to stay sober for 4 years. You know, going to meetings a little bit here and there. Before this 4 years sober, I had some more years, you know, sober, going to meetings here and there. You know, towards the end of the last couple years, you know, I did moderate my drinking, you know, for a while, until I didn't moderate my drinking. Right. And then when it progressed, it took me right back to crystal meth, which is like, you know, my demise. So when that happened, you know, I came back into the rooms and I got the fellowship part of the program. You know, I made it to like step 7 or something. And then I moved out of San Diego. And then I started working like in treatment. So I work in drug and alcohol treatment. And so I'm around it like all day long. And so, you know, when I reached out to Joe, you know, a few months ago and decided that, you know, I needed to get into the solution. You know, I started doing this workshop and I'm going through this chapter. And I, when we were talking about hard drinker, I messaged, Joe on chat and I said, Joe, am I a hard drinker? he says, no, you're not a hard drinker. Cause as soon as you take in, you know, you're going to lose control. And that's the truth. You know, if I start using, again, you know, I have no control over that. You know, I will lose control over how much I take. So.
Thank you. Thank you, Dylan.
Dylan Addict.
Hi.
Hi, Tyla. Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for sharing, Tyla. I get so much identification out of going through the big book, the BBA way, that I haven't gotten before. And so I'm so appreciative to be here and having a new experience. So I have a question, Tyla. Early in my recovery and being in the rooms of AA, I was taught that the allergy was caused in the alcoholic, with the difference between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic was that the acetone doesn't break down in the alcoholic body the way that it breaks down in the non-alcoholic body. And so I wanted to bring that to the group because on page 19, when you pointed out and you said, this is important, we shall bring the task of our combined experience, the big book, our living, the experience, right? Versus the knowledge, the head. Because when I share, I've always shared that way, that what makes the alcoholic is because the acetone doesn't break down. But tonight I heard you say it's because of the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body which those two, you gotta have both, which determines if a person is an alcoholic or not. And so my question is, since we're talking about the allergy, the physical allergy part, is that something to look at, that acetone doesn't break down normally in our bodies and that's the difference? Or,
well, the important thing is that how am I sharing it that makes sense to a newcomer? If I bring the acetone stuff to a newcomer, their eyes are going to just roll back in their head. I have to bring it in a way that is practical, that they can see it in their experience. Nowhere in the big book do they mention acetone, although it's that the metabolizing of acetone, it's all chemistry and it's interesting and it's true. But if it was so important, wouldn't they have put it in the big book? You know what I'm saying? So I have to share in a way that newcomer can see it in their life. And unless they have a pharmaceutical background, I don't know that they're going to understand the acetone. Not, Helen, not that it's not important. What you're saying is important. But remember, you have more recovery. I have to share it in a very simple way, the way the big book does. Loss of control, physical craving, mental obsession. I can't control how much when I start, and I can't control the stop. And just keeping it simple like that. But what you're saying is true. So there's no final answer, if that makes sense.
No, that does make sense. And thank you. I just wanted to make sure that information was relevant, that chemically, that's what happens when that chemical imbalance happens within the alcoholic. And I love how you always include the drug user, the addict, because yes, early in my recovery in the rooms, and mind you, Tyler, mm-hmm, I've only been in the rooms 14, 15 years. And that's so I never identified with the alcoholic, because I would always say, well, I didn't have that when I drank alcohol. I could sip a glass of wine all night long. But as soon as I hit the pipe, I had that reaction. And so it's so good to be in a place where that is shown, that just because it wasn't the liquid that I didn't have that reaction to, I did have that reaction to crack cocaine.
So did I.
Right.
But even if you are not an alcoholic, you still have to be free of all mind altering chemicals in order to be recovered and sober.
Right. Absolutely. And so on the top of 19, when we were talking about the hard one, that one sort of got to me too, because, no, not on the top of 19.
Yeah, 21.
On the top of 21, when it gives the description of the hard one, you know, I did question, but I came back with, no, you're the real one, because when you hit it, it was all bets off, to the point of prostitution, you know, jury, everything. It was all bets off, because when I got pregnant, I was able to stop. But when I put one in, I'm not able to stop.
Well, it's most important that you find your truth. And I think what you're saying is, I may be a hard drinker, but I'm a real addict. See, and so that may be true, but the point is that you can't do any of it anyway,
right?
You know, but it's good to know your own truth. But sometimes when you do drugs and alcohol, I've had people meditate on this. If when you were in your disease, if magically every single drug in the world was taken away from the earth, how would you drink?
Oh, it finally dawned on me. Okay, what you were asking me. Okay, if I didn't have the other, if I didn't
no
have
drug.
The other crutch.
You couldn't get a drug.
That's
right. Right. I see. How would I drink? That's good, Tyler. That's good.
Right?
Because right.
You can see that, you know, I think that probably you would drink more. But anyway, let me let some other people share. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great question. Who would like
Good
to share?
Evening. My name is Norma, and I'm an alcoholic, and I never talk. I never talk.
Hi, Norma. It's so good to hear you talk.
Yeah. Yeah, I never talk because I'm kind of shy and afraid to talk, and because I got a second language. But yes, my goodness, this has been such a blessing to me. I knew I needed to come here, Tyler. I told you it was important for me.
Yes. Oh, you knew. You knew. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Now, listen, I found out that I am a real alcoholic. And just like the lady before, my main drug, the last thing that I was using was crack cocaine. So therefore, when I came into the rooms, I was an addict. And I always wanted to be an alcoholic because that's where I found my medicine, right? That's where I found my solution. However, when I would drink, I wouldn't stop. I would drink the whole thing, but because I would vomit and I would have this acid, it would just burn my throat. I didn't like it. Then my brothers introduced me to crack cocaine. Now, why did they introduce me to crack cocaine? I think they knew I was an alcoholic and that I couldn't stop, because as soon as I put money in it, they would have dope. So every month I would go, I would not moderate it, but I didn't have the money to smoke all day long or every day. So I would save my money. As soon as I got my paycheck, I'd go to the Netherlands, because I lived in Germany. I'd rent a car so they wouldn't catch me with dope, with my own car. So I would plan the whole thing. Anyway, I would go to my brothers. I give them about a certain amount of money, knowing that they would steal from me, but I would still have my own stash, and I would smoke the whole thing, the whole weekend. And they would say, "My God, your heart's going to burst." Mm-hmm. They said, you got to take it easy. Your heart's going to burst. They said, "You smoke more than we do, man. You smoke like a man." And I was like, "I smoke like a man. I just don't know how else to smoke, because I couldn't stop, and I wanted more and more and more. And I only would stop if I didn't have no more money. I wouldn't hide anything. I couldn't hide anything because it was all gone. My drinking, I would always, at the end, I would stand up, and I couldn't stand up no more because I would fall over because I drank so much. So I am a real alcoholic. Thank you for letting me share. Thanks, Tyler.
Oh, sure. Josie, would you like to share?
I'm Joe. I'm a crystal meth addict and alcoholic. Thank you, Tyler, for sharing on this part. And next week, we're going to get into the mental, like you already talked about. And just going off of what some other people have shared, I had lots of excuses early on to where they didn't even matter anymore later. But like, oh, I'm just going to use this for this weekend, or I'm just going to do it here. And I believed some of those for a time. For a short period of time. And then it never even mattered because I would completely lose control anyway. And like, I'm just gonna do it on the weekend was ridiculous. I didn't even lie to myself anymore. It wasn't about I could lie to myself. And when I was going through this work, it was like, the mind wants to look at the one or two times I controlled it in the entire 9 years I drank and used, or the one or two times that I was able to do that and say, oh, look, there's the evidence. I might not be a real alcoholic, which is bullshit, but the way I drank and used was devastating to my life. It devastated my life and the lives around me. So there was no, when we get to the mental, it's the same thing. There was no more delusion. There was no more lying to myself. And I never, I don't want to say that. Let's say this. I'm practicing filtering. But these excuses that I had, like the way I drank and used, I'm looking at the physical allergy. We're still looking at the physical here. I mean, I look at this hard drinker, moderate drinker, and a real alcoholic. Do I lose control of the amount once I start? The behavior of my life, the way I was raised, all that stuff had nothing to do with what makes me an alcoholic or an addict physically, right? None of it. Like, oh, I was this when I was a child, or this happened to me when I was a kid. That might've pushed me to start, but it never answered the question, why? Why is it I continue? Why is it my brother had the same kind of lifestyle my dad left out all of us? You know what I mean? Just because I'm gay, I know gay people who aren't addicts and alcoholics. They're very few, but they're there, and I'm just kidding. There's people that had worse lives than me, and they're not where I'm at. you know? So we don't look at the behavior. We don't look at the circumstances of my life as to answer the question why. So my common problem that I'm looking at in the rooms is not necessarily what happened to me, you know? It's the loss of control. And so I'm looking inside for the problem. I'm not looking out here. The drama, it's easy to get caught up in the drama and the stories. It's good to relate. And that's a good, it's a good temperature check to look at with the drama of how I lost control, because the result of my loss of control is the drama. Now, when it comes to drugs and alcohol, if I drink vodka, I have a physical craving for more, and I'm going to satisfy that craving by sticking a needle in my arm. You know what I mean? I might go to more vodka, I might go to drugs, but the craving has been activated. So I don't like when addicts are like, oh, I don't have that, you know, whatever. For me, I'm both. I have a craving no matter what, you know. Vodka, tequila, whatever it is, will take me to meth. And meth will take me to the bushes or wherever I need to go. And, you know, it takes me on a run. I remember telling my boyfriend I'll be right back. I did a little meth and I'm gone for 3 days. I was supposed to go get some milk, you know? And here I am. Where am I at? I don't know. I'm fucking lost in a park somewhere, you know? And this is just where the drugs took me. But it's loss of control. When I put it in my body, do I lose control over the amount? And does my experience abundantly confirm this? And that's what I'm looking at physically. And I know people who have left AA, and I don't get all sad and, oh my God, they're gonna die, all this drama. My hat is fucking off to you because I know that's not me. This is about finding my own truth, you know? I know people who have left the program who had more convictions than me, they were smoking meth with an ankle bracelet in the house, you know what I mean? And they left the program after 5 years, and they can control their drinking, and they can control, they don't want to use meth anymore, but they can control their drinking and they're happy, and my hat's off to them. That's not me, you know? Every time I've gone back to alcohol, every time I've gone back to pot, every time I've gone back to any drugs or anything, it's taken me to a place of devastation in my life, of devastation of losing everything, you know? So there's no more delusion here. I can't lie to myself anymore, you know? I just can't. And so this chapter really sums up the rest of the physical. I know they add mental in here, but when I'm looking at these questions, I'm looking at more so, can I moderate or control? Can I moderate or control it? Can I go through treatment for 30 days? Can I go through, get in a relationship, and then maybe I can start using less because they want me to? There's good consequences and there's bad consequences, because some things are going to be, I'm going to lose my job if I don't stop drinking and using. And some things are, oh, I'm about to get a new good job, I better stop drinking or using, you know? Can I control it either way? Maybe it's getting in a relationship or getting out of a relationship. And I look at those sufficient reasons, and it says becomes operative. That means do this or else. But when I'm looking at the sufficient reasons, I'm looking at the sufficient reason alone. I'm not looking at the sufficient reason and some meetings and the program, or maybe a little sponsoring on the side. It's, can the judge, when he tells me, if you drink or use again, you're going to go to jail, can I take that sufficient reason, go out and do some controlled drinking, you know? That's what I'm looking at here. And for me, it's a no-brainer. I mean, so thanks for letting me share, all. Have a good night.
Thank you. Yon, Joe.
Hi, Veronica.
Go on.
Oh, I'm Veronica and I'm an alcoholic. And you know,
hi,
everybody. I know that I'm the real alcoholic. You know, I knew this a while ago when I read this, you know, because for the hard drink, if the doctor gives him a sufficient enough reason, you know, he can even stop drinking. But for me, that was never the case. I had hepatitis C, you know, and I was raised in a neighborhood where a lot of our neighbors died of alcoholism, of cirrhosis, like in their 30s. So I was well aware of what cirrhosis was like, well aware that the way I drink around the clock that I could, you know. So for years with hepatitis C, I did. And I started this research project that was going to get rid of my hepatitis C, but I had to have a drink before I got there. You know, knowing that that would disclude me from this program, but worried like hell when they did the liver biopsy, you know, to find out whether or not I had cirrhosis, but could not stop drinking. You know, could not stop drinking, even knowing this loss of control. You know, once I took that drink, I lost control of everything. You know, I lost control of what I did, where I was going to end up. You know, towards the end of my drinking was like laying in the bed, drinking and crying because I knew that I was going to die of cirrhosis eventually because I could not stop drinking. you know, and I did not know how to stop drinking. And sometimes I would even look out of my window, and I live like in downtown San Diego. I live where it's rough, you know. But I would say, now, if you take this drink, you don't know where you're going to end up, okay? Because when I take that drink, somehow I end up out there on 15th and J Street, like all during the night, and the end of smoking crack and everything, and I'm out there, and I knew that I had been kidnapped. This had happened to me, that had happened to me. So I'm like in the window, I'm like, oh my God, but I gotta take this drink. Okay, but you're just not gonna go out there. But then I would always feel good and say, oh hell, it's okay, you know, get my shit on and go out there. But then, you know, I didn't know whether I was gonna end up coming back.
Oh yeah.
I wanted to live, but I wasn't sure I was gonna make it back because I was jumping in and out of cars, and I never knew what situation I was gonna be in. But I still took that drink and knowing the consequences, you know. And so, but it was something that I could not control. You know, I got to the point where I could not live with it. To drink would make me very sick, and I wasn't having no fun. But to do without it, I just could not do without it. So I reached that point. I was between there. Mm-hmm. I couldn't live with it. I couldn't live without it. It was a point of misery, you know, and I can truly relate to this, man. You know, I can truly relate to this, you know, that. Thank you for you know, sharing about this tonight. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Veronica. Such a good share. Thank you. Jan, would you like to share?
Yeah, I'd love to. My name is Jan. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. And thank you, Tyler, for breaking it down so beautifully. And thank you to everybody else that shared. And thank you, Rachel, as well, for highlighting your experience. And I'm really grateful that I had a lot of friends that were kind of in your position, where we drank and used together, and we would stay up for days, you know, snorting cocaine, popping a bunch of ecstasy, drinking heavily. And, you know, around mid-20s, I started to notice that they started to evolve in their lives. You know, they started getting girlfriends and maybe having kids, and, you know, things are shifting around, and they're starting to dial it back. You know, they're starting to just drink IPAs and just smoke weed maybe here and there. And I'm just progressing further and further. Now I'm smoking meth, and now I'm doing harder drugs, and now I'm going longer and longer and longer. And I was really able to see that going through the Big Book Awakening when it asked me that question. I'm really grateful for, you know, the study guide highlighting that, because it really brought it back to my own experience. And I was able to see so clearly how bodily different I am from my fellows, you know. But there really wasn't that much doubt, you know. Like, I knew every time that I drank, I'm kind of like Joe, where it's like, I'm getting drugs, you know. There's a switch. I take a shot of vodka, and next thing I know, I need a bag of meth, and then I need some more vodka, and then I need a cigarette, and then I need to hit the meth again, and then I need another shot of vodka. And you know, the start of those nights, I wasn't telling myself that I was going to do meth. I was telling myself, oh, maybe I'm going to go out and just enjoy the night, you know. And I remember there was a time that I did that. I got off of work, you know, I'm wearing a suit. I was working at Macy's, and I got off. I'm like, oh yeah, I'm going to go get a drink tonight, and just, you know, maybe holler at some girls. And I get to the bar and, you know, start drinking. And then next thing I know, I want drugs. And I'm doing that, and the bar closes. And now I'm standing on the street, and I'm looking for somebody to hang out with. And it's 2 a.m, it's 3 a.m. There's only homeless people around. And I end up, you know, hanging out with some people, drinking, doing more meth until around like 4 or 5 a.m. And these guys are like, oh yeah, we're going to go to the mission. And I'm like, I don't know. I'm just like out of my mind. I don't know what that is. And I end up at a homeless shelter at 6 a.m. reading the Bible with black diamond earrings in, you know, and like a backpack with a dab rig and like an ounce of hash oil. And like, what the fuck am I doing? You know? And like, that's where my physical craving takes me. And so it was really easy for me to identify myself as an alcoholic and addict. And I'm really grateful for that. But I understand the difficulties. I've worked with quite a few people in the few years that I've been sober. And I also got to work in recovery. And I see that this disease progresses differently in different people. And I was sharing this with Rick when we were going through the work, where, you know, I've had guys come into the sober living that I was managing. They're coming in at 46, 50 years old, and they had drinking their whole lives, but it wasn't until, you know, they had a family, they had a career, and they could manage and moderate, and they were drinking. And then all of a sudden, it just like off like a ski slope, you know, like, bam, now I can't, the physical craving has progressed in their life. And all of a sudden, they're just drinking 7 days in a row. They're not eating, they're not drinking water, and then, you know, ending up in detox. And it happens just like that. And so you know, this disease manifests differently in different people, and it's really important to look at the internal, like we've been discussing. But thankfully for me, I identify with all the external stuff too, you know, so it's really, really easy for me to see that I'm a different person when I drink. I'm amoral, I'm irresponsible, I'm loud, I'm obnoxious, I'm unfaithful. You know, I'm the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you know, and so I'm really grateful for this work, for helping me to identify and see my truth. And without it, I don't think I would be as grounded in an understanding and an experience of what this book is trying to tell me. So thank you.
Thank you. I got a question, Jan. Jan?
Yeah.
All the things you just said you are when you drink, all the behaviors, were you ever the opposite? Were you ever moral when you drank or used?
Not really. I mean, I don't think so. I mean, I struggle with like the selfishness, like, oh, you're selfish, alcoholic. I'm like, what do you mean? I was buying people drinks. I was sharing my drugs, you know, but like, okay, there was always some manipulative, amoral reason for everything that I was doing.
Okay.
You know?
I just had to ask.
Yes.
I don't know if we're stopping, but I just wanted
No, you can go on and share, honey. We'll stop after your share.
Vanessa, I'm an alcoholic. So there was a couple of things that I wanted to mention, just because for me, every single time we go through this section and also into Wives, I'm like, oh, maybe I'm not a real alcoholic. And I question, and especially because of the way we talk about it here, I'm just gonna be honest, to the point that I wonder sometimes, is it wise to talk like this to a newcomer? Because for me, I have to stay for the whole conversation, because my mental obsession is so, and my perceptions are so messed up, that still to this day, my ego and my disease thinking tells me I'm not a real alcoholic, right? So everyone's talking and I'm like, ooh, maybe I'm not. I don't know, you know, because I had a high bottom. I was like one of those high bottom people they talk about, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But then I hear things like, you know, the physical, can I stop when I start? Can I control how much I take? That piece is so important. And it's what I do with my sponsees, is constantly bring them back to that physical question. It is so important. It is the thing that keeps me here. It is the thing that brought me here. I actually read the brochures. Someone gave them to me 3 years before I came into the rooms. I pulled it out and I did I went and I tried to have cool drinks. It didn't work. You know, so that physical piece, I think, is so easy to brush under the rug, but it's the most important thing for me to understand that I am a real alcoholic. I am a real drug addict, considering that nicotine is a drug. Donna and I were talking a lot about this, about with the cigarettes and that physical part with the cigarettes. Can I have just one? Can I stop? Can I control it? You know, it's like, no, you know, like I am addicted to nicotine. I am addicted to alcohol and drugs, you know? So it's that physical piece to me is so important, just to really understand. Because we always want to go to that mental part, right? Even when I started this conversation, but it's like that physical piece, I cannot control it once I stop, and I cannot stop. So
thank you. Yeah, can you just have two drinks and stop?
Nope,
couldn't do it. I mean, can I just go and have three drinks and stop? No, but what you said is so great, Vanessa, because that's why it's so important to separate it when you work with someone. You got to get the physical down first. So it's great to be here with everyone tonight. I want to let Joe, do you have anything to say for next week, honey? Joe's
no,
speaking.
Just bring your mind. We're talking about the minds. Clean your mind.
So you'll be going from 23 to 29.
Yep.
And also read the spiritual experience in the back of the book.
Yes. I think that this part is the hardest for people to see. I think it's much easier to identify with the physical than it is with the mental, because people don't want to, they still think they can control it. So that I can control my mind. I can stay stopped. I can just not drink no matter what. But the physical is a little bit.
Okay, Joe, can you just drink no matter what?
I just drink no matter what. That's it. Anyway, we'll get into it next week. It's very, this is this week and next week are some of the most important information in the big book. Mm-hmm. It's a lot mm-hmm. of work. So don't forget to do your homework.
Don't do your homework and we'll see you. Does anyone have any questions or any quick comments that before or any questions? And then we will wrap it up and we'll be on for a few minutes after the workshop. And real quick, I want to announce you guys, there's a new BBA meeting starting April 3rd, Saturday at 6 o'clock at the Live and Let Live Alano Club. It's up on the website if you want to come to the meeting. So let's, Vanessa, would you take us out with the Serenity Prayer? Thank you, everyone. God bless you all. Thank you so much for this meeting.
Thank you, Tyler. God bless
you, everyone. God, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, courage to change the things we can,
and the wisdom to know the difference.
Amen. Thank you. Amen.